25th. Dennis, which, what, you got those people online?
You want to take up two...
232.
255.
All right, okay. No, I wasn't gonna take, I wanted to get this other one out of the way first.
You come from the building, right, 249?
Yeah. Okay, the first item we'll take up is income on the permanent fund. Is there anybody here to testify on 249? I thought that we might have somebody from the governor's office. Is Rieger, was that not the one that Rieger testified on? We have a committee substitute before us on that, committee substitute for 249. Okay. Dave, you had handled, that had been in your subcommittee, had it not?
Right, we're on 255 or 249?
249.
Okay. We did, and I thought they had given the committee staff substitute. Good. Okay, I was looking at the other permanent fund bill.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Do you want me to describe what we did?
Yes, right. Mm-hmm, what happened?
We got together, went over it, and the conclusion we came to was to incorporate the technical amendments that David Teal had described at our previous meeting. And those basically correct some ambiguities that exist about how permanent fund earnings are supposed to be allocated. His argument had been that the corporation may not be authorized to make changes that need to be made. And so we corrected those. Some people viewed them as a problem, others didn't, but there didn't seem to be any problem with trying to solve them. Then the only thing we did to change the previous bill, the actual substance of it, was to take the floor of $750 and increase it to $827. That way, it won't be a drop in the level of permanent fund dividends, even though they'll be stabilized for a long time, $827. And we changed the effective date, so it's effective immediately and would apply to the upcoming round of permanent fund dividends.
Okay.
That's the only change we made.
Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on this? David, did you have any?
Mr. Chairman, if there are questions, I can hopefully answer them, but I don't have anything to say about it.
Are there any questions from the committee on it? Dave, do you have any questions?
No, I have a discussion. I have a discussion.
Okay. We have committee substitute. Is there any objection to putting committee substitute 249 before the body? If not, it's under discussion now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think anytime you adjust the permanent fund, you're taking a very, very serious step. And the one message came loud and clear from the people in my district was, leave the permanent fund alone. If it's not broke, go fix it. And things seem to be running okay to me, and this thought that maybe they don't have the authority to do this or that, I don't buy it. It's a good enough reason to amend something that's been in place for this long, it's functioning this well. Additionally, this adjustment makes the dividend plateau, then the public will have no interest whatsoever, really, because they won't see any monetary reason to protect the permanent fund from raids, political raids, because that's the whole idea, is the less we think with this and the more money goes into the corpus, the bigger the checks get. And that was the theory in the beginning, and I still think it's a successful theory to protect it. So I'm gonna do not pass this legislation.
Okay. Representative Zawaki?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I guess I have to concur with Representative Donnelly. I think if we just remember a few days ago, we passed another piece of legislation. In fact, Mr. Chairman, your piece of legislation creating the permanent fund, it was a board or commission, I'm sorry. And their requirement is going to be, if it is passed in the Senate, their requirement is going to be to go throughout the entire state to all four judicial districts and give input and get input specifically on the permanent fund, the corpus, the dividends, the inflation factor, the earnings, and get the public input and come back to us by January, I believe, or February of 1990. That vote on the floor, Mr. Chairman, happened to be something like 35 or 36 to 4, if I remember. I think there's a clear message by the House representative saying that since we've established this commission, it should be their responsibility, and I think that any legislation that we are looking at now that has anything to do with the permanent fund should be directed to that new board, and we should not be making decisions until we fully hear from the public.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The I think the points made are well taken. The when it comes to the commission, though, the commission isn't going to have its results until next year, next session. It's a interim commission, and this bill isn't going to pass this year, regardless of what this committee does. It's not going to be on a fast track of any sort. I'd like to see it pass, but it won't. And so I think the commission will have all of the public input and other deliberations it's had at hand to offer advice on this bill and other bills as it comes up. So I don't see any conflict between this and the commission. And in regard to some of the other points raised about this bill, it's true on the surface, the permanent fund system doesn't look like there's anything broken. But what it comes down to is the kind of years we've had with the income of the fund. There is going to be a point, one of these years, where the permanent fund corporation's projections are going to come true. Somehow they never come true. It's because they're a little bit conservative, but it's mostly because we've had good years in investments. When it doesn't come true, we're going to have a year when we have less money for inflation proofing. And I can't predict the long-term cycles of our economy, but our permanent fund is vulnerable by having inflation proofing second. And really, the only thing that this bill does that's really sweeping is put inflation proofing before dividends. I think that's a critical change that needs to be made. And it's not even clear that there was ever any intention to have dividends before inflation proofing. The way the law was put together was a hodgepodge of things thrown into the bill. It was an interpretation which should come first in the various calculations. So the outcome, you know, the point made about the plateau is true. That is one of the outcomes. Is the permanent fund dividend is going to plateau at $827 for a while under this legislation. But I don't think people are going to lose interest in a permanent fund. I don't think they're going to lose interest in how it's managed. A family of four is still going to get $3,500 a year from the permanent fund. I think that's plenty to keep them interested. So I would encourage passage of this legislation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I respect Representative Finkelstein's comments on that, but I think we're going to be sending a mixed message out there. And again, I'll repeat what I said earlier. You took the time, Mr. Chairman, to put together legislation, and even though I disagreed with, you know, the concept, I don't disagree with the concept, I disagree with the commission. But the fact of the matter is, anytime we decide to work on anything that's got to do with the permanent fund, we are telling that commission that's not even out there yet doing their job, and we're going to tell the public that regardless of what we want you to do and what you want, you know, we're going to ignore you. We're going to ignore you before we even go out there to do our job as a commission. We're going to ignore you, public, because we want your input. We want it so that we can address it next year. But we're going to ignore it anyway because we're going to continue to pass legislation that reflects the permanent fund. I think it has a direct bearing. I think we're going out there and slighting the public and slighting the commission that we're going to form to do the job that we're asking them to do. We're just going to ignore what they're going to bring back to us if we continue to pass any legislation. I will be honest. I object to inflation factoring being the first thing. So there's going to be disagreement by us. That's the reason we've established the commission.
Representative McLean.
Thank you. I'd like to go on record to state that I support this bill because I feel that the victim should be given some of the funds from the dividend.
Yes, we're on 249.
Then I'm on the wrong bill.
I was Because it says permanent fund on it, so.
The one that was on the top was the wrong one.
And my apologies, you've just gotten in, like, we had 249 before, so that's the one, by the Finance Committee, an act relating to income from the permanent fund and providing for an effective date. We'll be taking 255 up next.
Okay.
249, Mr. Chairman, if I may, 249 is actually what it's setting up, is it's going to provide inflation proofing as the first area that monies will be used.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that Representative Finkelstein does make a good point in the fact that we got 13, 12 days left or something, realizing that this legislation will not pass. And the fact that the commission on your bill, which Representative Zawacki has talked about, that was an interim commission and will give the report back. I think that that is a valid point in saying that, or going against the argument that Representative Zawacki is saying that we're sending the mixed message. I think that the fact that we will have the interim commission's report back before this legislation passes still allows whether this bill would pass both bodies at that time.
What's your point, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this bill probably provides a good basis of information that should go out with the commission. Now, I think, like so many things that perhaps what's being reflected by Representatives Zawacki and Donnelly, if the people decide this is the way to go, then that same interest in protection will occur. If they get the explanation that this will certainly, by putting the inflation proofing first, that we're really protecting the corpus, that we're really protecting our savings account, and are you willing to, you know, go with an $837 permanent fund dividend check for the next 8 or 9 years to protect that fund? And maybe they'll say yes, or maybe they'll say no. I personally think that that's probably a good way to go, particularly if we kind of put a floor there now that's at the same level that we've been receiving. We're not putting a floor there at $500. So hopefully there'll be some support. But I think the prospect of having something like this pass, or the prospect of doing this, will be much greater if the people buy into it. And maybe that would be a good, one of, certainly something that the commission, one of the things that should be on the table before the people. Should we have the inflation proofing first before we do the dividend, with a good explanation of what that accomplishes? And then maybe we'll have the best of all worlds. We'll be protecting the principle, and we'll have the support of the people to do that, rather than we as 60 legislators deciding this is the way it's going to be done. And then I think you get the resentment that who were they to tell us, you know, that we're not going to have increasing permanent fund dividend checks every year. So I still think it's a good concept. Hopefully, you know, it'll be interesting to see if the people out there, the state, think it's a good concept. And that should be one of the objects of the commission. One of their goals would be to certainly make this concept clear to the people.
Any other comments? Let me just share my thoughts with you on it. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think by moving this on up to Finance Committee, in the minute they bring that up, there'll be lightning rods from all over the place that begin to discuss it. It'll elevate the discussion of that thing to the table. I'm not going to vote to pass the legislation, wouldn't vote to pass it on the floor. But I think pretty well you've seen the way I function, that I'm just not going to sit on it like an egg as the overall authoritarian. They said that this is an idea, I'll put it up there. In fact, the governor's office came down and said, well, we're not quite sure where we stand on the thing. I would do everything that I could, even though I might let it out of my committee, to see, for the very reasons that have been brought up here, that it was subject to absolute thorough debate that the people were involved in. So I don't feel threatened if it moves on out of this committee. I think what it'll do is, if I sit on it, it'll sit over here and somebody will wonder what that bill is. But if I move it out and it comes up and somebody begins to discuss it, I think that the public reaction to it would be immediate, not whether it's good or bad, but hey, we want some input on that. So that's my thoughts on the thing. Now, what's the pleasure of the committee?
Mr.
Representative Finkelstein.
Mr. Chairman, based on what you just said, I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill 249 with individual recommendation.
Any objections?
No objection here, Mr. Chairman.
Beg pardon?
I have an objection here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Speak the objection.
Well, again, not to belabor the point or be repetitive on it, you know, I think for this legislative session to start to move, any legislation that is going to relate to the permanent fund is defeating the purpose of what we've just established a few days ago. That's what we have established the commission for, to take the responsibility to compile everything that we, in a sense, have thrown on the table, take it out to the people, take it out to the public, give that input to them, plus get that input and work with the public out there so that they can come back with a clear, decisive message from the public. And to, and my feeling is to upsert that now, to continue to move legislation through, you know, and I think in hopes that somebody will think that this is, convince the public this is the right thing to do. You're totally upsurping what we've established out there. What is the sense of having your commission if we're going to continue to push legislation through at our will? And we either have to do it one way or the other.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think Representative Zawacki's concerns are valid. The I just, you know, have to promise you that it, well, I can't promise, but I clearly have to predict that this will not be a measure passed by this legislature, and the public will just perceive it as another measure that's on the table, another proposal to be commented on. And I do share the chairman's view on sitting legislation, so I'd
we can send it out of this committee with a message. I intend to. I mean,
yeah, certainly.
I'm not a do pass on the thing, but I'm not. I try not to be an obstructionist. Okay, all those in favor of it moving out of committee with individual recommendations, hold up their hand. Opposed? Okay. I don't think it's going to be too many do passes.
Two groups from when we start the teleconference, no one's on until 9:15, so.
Let me get my act together. Okay. The next item we have before us is House Bill 255. We got a lot of agonizing stuff here.
Chairman, I just before that, I'd like to point out that title is a real problem in that bill, too. If people don't take the time and work on legislation, we're going to create more problems than we're ever going to believe. Sure is.
This, since it relates to permanent fund, we ought to let the commission take this to the public and get their feeling about felons and whether they should have the permanent fund evidence. As long as it's got it in the title, Mr. Chairman, I think that's what the commission's responsibility should be.
Well, Mr. Chairman, while we're on the subject, if that bill turns into something else in the Finance Committee, I think we should stand up on the floor and demand that it come back to this committee.
No, I'll do that. I can.
I've seen the Finance Committee change several things that we've sent up there this year and actually should have come back to this committee because they were a whole different subject.
Thinking about that commission, I just wondered, are the prospects good in the Senate for that commission?
Yes.
Is that okay? Because I was thinking, you know,
it's
you're talking
on
about
the state
past,
affairs.
And it,
usually when you get about a 36-4, you know, the numbers look pretty good for the Senate.
Okay.
Well,
all right.
It's like when we get about an 18-1 or 2.
Okay, what have we got?
Do you want to report on 255, the subcommittee's work so far?
Yeah, okay.
Well, Representative Zawacki and I have talked several times, talked several times to Representative Boyer. I've my staff working on it. It happens.
Take it easy, David, don't.
Gonna do a David Thompson.
I've had my staff working on several proposals.
We're bare in this committee, you know, in case you break away.
We've come at it from a lot of different angles here, Mr. Chairman, and so far we've just hit walls each time. We've had, spent a lot of time with the drafters trying to find if there was a constitutional way to allow access to this money without changing the existing system, and we simply haven't come up with it yet, despite a lot of effort in this area. And my suggestion is, unlike the previous legislation, I certainly understand the chair's interest in moving things, but this is a bill that should be worked out here in this committee, I think. And I think this bill should stay with us until we've got something that makes more sense.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question of the chairman of the subcommittee? In discussing the bill, did you find that there was a constitutional question about treating felons differently by some having their permanent fund checks attached for child support and others? Was that, what was the constitutional consideration or problems?
To the chair, if you set up a separate fund and allow access to it only by people who have certain types of claims, the drafters have concerns with that. And if you chunk the existing system and go to a system where people have to sign and apply for their dividends, I think that's a real bad move doing that. And that's the only way that they've proposed so far, and Representative Boyer seems to have encountered the same difficulty in drafting, to provide for direct access to the funds by these folks. I'm still exploring a couple options of a non-discriminatory access to funds that were set up, and it's going to take time to hammer these out with the drafters. We're not done on equal protection and due process questions. It's a really difficult issue, but I'm convinced that the way the bill is drafted now, and mandating that felons apply for these, is just not good public policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the fact that felons have to apply for these, what is the problem with it? I missed that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, under the new law, the Department of Revenue just sets aside, calculates how many prisoners we've got, and sets aside that much money from the permanent fund income. This law would require that, would eliminate the law we passed last year, that system. And the only way this money would be available is if the incarcerated prisoners themselves applied for permanent fund checks. If they go ahead and apply for permanent fund checks, then the money is available in the existing statutes for garnishment. But if they know that they're going to get garnished and they're not going to get any check, well then, unless they want know where the check's going to go, who's going to be doing the garnishing, and they happen to like who's doing the garnishing, there's no incentive, no reason for them to apply for the checks whatsoever. Because under the statutes, there's three total exemptions. They don't get a dime if it goes to child support, victim restitution, or I think there's one other thing. And so why bother to apply?
Well, I think there are some felons, I would hope, that are in there that would apply to allow it to go to their children or to go to something like that. I think that's a valid argument that I support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the fact that, you know, maybe they wouldn't, maybe they wouldn't be so inclined if they thought it was just going to a creditor, someone that was out there that was trying to get that. But the reality is it does give them the option to go ahead and apply or not apply.
Okay. Representative
Dwacky? Yeah, maybe on the comment, though, I think there are probably also several felons in there that maybe they don't have a requirement for child support out there, whether they're married or not. Maybe they do have a responsibility to the victims out there. In fact, the bill last year, we tried to specifically get additional money in to cover the victims. You probably have a lot of felons that would realize if it's going to go to those victims, they'll probably say, up yours, you know, and I'm just not going to sign off. You know, the hell with those victims out there. what we need to do, whether it's this legislation or maybe a new piece of legislation, is somehow probably keep the statutes that we have, but instead of them signing it off, we know that we get $1.5 million or $2 million worth of permanent funds because of the fellas out there. Set up a system whereby we don't even have to need their signature. Allocate $2 million annually, or whatever the amount is, directly into administration. We can, by statute, increase the amount going to child support. We can, by statute, increase the amount going for to the victims. The governor this year wanted in his fiscal 90 budget an increase in both of those areas. We can do it. All we've got to do is get the governor, Department of Revenue, to increase those amounts in both of those areas right now. That's where the concern, I think, with Representative Donnelly. Why change what we've got? We could do it in statute, put in a line item if we get the Department of Revenue to get serious. Well, you know, they may talk about victims and they may talk about child support. They can do it right now. Maybe they should put a little more responsibility in putting money in there instead of increasing additional employment out there. That's our concern. Why change something that can work right now? The only thing we really have to do is find the mechanism to automatically transfer those funds over without having the felon sign for it or not sign for it. And I agree with you. You know, if it's a child, some of them might say, you know, I'd like to turn it over to my child for child support or be responsible. But there's a hell of a lot of felons out there who just say, forget it. I'm not going to let anybody get that, including me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think all the points made are well taken on this. There's obviously a bunch of different sides, but I tend to come to a different conclusion. I favor legislation. I'd like to see it move. The bigger picture when I look at this is I do see two demands, or at least two demands on these dividends that are both important ones. And I'm committed to compensation of victims as well. I think it's a general fund obligation, as it has been in the past, and I think it's one we need to continue. I don't think that it supersedes the needs of children in these what tend to be a lot of hardship cases. I'd like to do both. I think the way to do both is to pass this legislation and fight for more funding, general fund funding for victims' compensation if there's a problem there. There are going to be problems in implementation of this. I agree, all the points that Representative Donnelly's making are good ones. But there's problems with the existing law. I mean, right now we're in court over the existing law, and you know, I guess there's a reasonable chance that it's not going to be considered equal protection in the final decision on those cases, and we'll have no law in place here. This legislation solves that matter. There will be equal protection, and based on that, I'd favor its passage.
What's the pleasure of committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move this legislation with individual recommendations.
I'd object too, Mr. Chairman. There is two proposed amendments in the packet. I don't want to move this bill. I think it's badly conceived, and it does a great deal of harm. It does more harm than it does good. I don't think it should leave this committee, but if it does leave this committee, it should at least have the two amendments.
All right. Okay.
But I still would strongly oppose doing those amendments. And I think that it's really not good process to hurry something this complex through its House Bill 255. It's not like we've had time to work on it either, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Dave, we all do things different ways, and I know how you handle legislation. I know how you feel about victims, so I have to sit here and weigh those things. I know I feel as strongly as you do about victims. I feel holding this up is not going to solve the problem that's the closest to you. And I've tried my best to get, you said, I've asked Boyer if the two of you got together on the thing. And I know you would prefer not to see it go over to the next committee of referral on there. But if this thing has got judicial problems, you know,
It's technical problems, the way it's set up. I mean, to access.
Well, nobody,
it's a state affairs
you know,
issue.
Huh?
It's state affairs issues, the problems with the bill.
Well, I don't see much progress being made on anybody doing anything on it.
Well,
worked on it yesterday, worked on it the day before.
Okay, well, let's see if we get Boyer down here. Yeah, I'll move that to the bottom of the calendar.
The committee substitute, which dated 4/24, includes the amendments.
Okay. Let's get the other parties that are in here on the thing.
Do you want to present the Boyer now?
Yeah, if he can get down here in a couple of minutes and we can get going on this.
Mr. Chairman, I've heard a couple people say, the way to address this is through the operating budget. But frankly, Mr. Chairman, when this issue was before the Finance Committee several times this year, there was nobody else up there advocating for more money for these programs. When it came to caucus, there was nobody else advocating for more money for these programs.
For which program?
For the victims program.
Hey,
In fact, they've been severely cut in the Department of Law, but there wasn't a single vote in caucus to put this money back in. So it's all well and fine to talk about that as an excuse to allow this bill to move, but unless somebody's willing to actually do something about it, I mean, it's kind of a specious argument. Now, there's some commitment here from the members at the table that we're ready to take this on in caucus and put this money into the budget in the Department of Law where it belongs. Well, then I might see something that there would be, some sort of commitment to that. But I haven't seen that commitment by anybody. I've seen people ignoring the victims this whole year.
Well, you're addressing me on that.
Well, no, I'm addressing everybody.
Yeah. Well,
so
I
people
would
say this isn't, that we got to take care of another place, but then they don't say anything when it's in that other place. Well, then, what does that argument mean?
Your point's well taken. I mean, I don't recall it coming up specifically in caucus. I would certainly have supported it. I mean, there's so much flying around as it relates to the Finance Committee. But if you would come to me and say, hey, I want some support in increasing this, I assure you I will give you my support if that's to what level you figure it should be funded at. Now, that's just my word to you on the thing, because I'm a co-sponsor on your legislation. Okay, well, obviously we're having some discussion on this one. Okay, we have an amendment here. We have the committee substitute, which incorporated the amendment. Is that not correct?
Correct.
And so let's get the committee substitute before us. We have committee substitute before HB 255 before us. Is there any objection? All right, let's address ourselves to Representative Donnelly's concern that he expressed for.
And this is the case of
yes.
Representative Finkelstein.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could have someone briefly describe to us what the changes do.
Representative Boyer.
Mr. Chairman, what we did is add a new section 1 and 2, and what those do is set up a mechanism for making deposits from the permanent fund dividend of convicted felons to the Violent Crimes Compensation Fund. Or the Crime Victim Compensation Fund, and that amount would be $50, as you see in Section 2. For every dividend, the Department of Revenue would take $50 and put it into the Crime Victim Compensation Fund, and it sets up in that priority of taking of the dividend the Crime Victim Compensation Fund as the third taker, so that essentially you have right now you would have the CSED is the first takedown, the second take is to court-ordered restitution, and the third taking would be then the $50 to the crime victim compensation fund. So it sets up, it establishes that taking in the existing priority under the permanent fund dividend.
Do you have?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought the committee substitute was going to also incorporate the other proposal, but it doesn't.
Which one?
The proposal.
And that's the only change in the CS.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to begin with, I'd move to amend the CS to adopt the proposed language in the Cook bill draft of 31387. And staff doesn't have copies of this, I have a copy here.
Which one?
It was my understanding that the proposed CS incorporated that already.
Yes,
but
does it not?
No.
Where's Dennis?
It does not, as I understand. If that's the Donnelly proposed Donnelly amendment?
Okay, now which one do we...
Well, I'm moving to amend the CS to adopt that amendment there.
Could you, Mr. Chairman?
What is the amendment?
Do
we have the Donnelly amendment in the packet?
No, I didn't see that one.
Where did this?
Let's make some copies of it.
Let's make some copies.
I didn't receive this.
Right. It was never formally before the committee. Never was.
Were you instructed by the subcommittee to prepare the CS?
No, I was instructed by Representative Boucher.
Okay, well, that's why you didn't see it. It didn't come from the subcommittee.
If you don't get it over here, how is he going to put it in the packet?
Well, the subcommittee hadn't completed its work.
All right, okay.
Can you just describe just generally?
One of the main arguments against this legislation is that there'd be no incentive for the... incarcerated felons to apply for these checks, given the exemption status that they didn't get any money if the checks were going to go to either victims or child support or the other things, and if they didn't want it to happen, there'd be no incentive for them to apply for them whatsoever under the existing way the exemptions are set up. And basically what that says is any normal debtor can only access 50% of the dividend check, right? But if you're for child support or victim has court-ordered restitution, or one other thing, I think maybe taxes or something
fines.
Then you can access all of it. So if you can access all of it, what's the motivation if you're requiring these people to apply for it? There's no motivation. So this amendment would change it so it'd be across the board $100 exemption. Anybody who was entitled to a check would get at least $100 of it. So there'd always be a motive for them to apply for it. Even if they didn't like who got the other $700, at least they'd give it $100, so they'd at least have a reason to apply for it.
Well, okay, are you recommending this as a committee substitute?
I recommended it. I've moved it as an amendment to the committee substitute.
All right. Well, let's take a... Have you had an opportunity? Has everybody had an opportunity to absorb it?
Mr. Chairman, the practical effect of the amendment, though, is to literally take from every recipient. We're not talking... This is not a felon amendment. This is all recipients. So currently, you've got a group of felons who are getting nothing, but the world of all other dividend recipients would be affected by this amendment by allowing that a person who now is Joe on the street who owes child support enforcement or court-ordered restitution or fines and penalties to the state or any other state program like the student loan program or something like that, that those people who perhaps are not receiving any part of their dividend now because it's all going for one of those purposes would also be entitled to keep $100. That's the effect of the amendment. So it does not directly speak to felons. It's the world of all other recipients.
Chairman, I'd just like to ask a question to Representative Donnelly. Well, this seems like it would work, I'll tell you that. That's one thing about it. It definitely got the motivation. Do you think it would work at $50? Do you think that that would be a sufficient motivation?
Didn't even think about it. I just tried to pick a number that would make a very significant incentive for people to still apply for these things.
My only suggestion is I do think this approach would work, and I'm also worried about what Representative Boyer said, the effect on other garnishments throughout the state. So I think we should try to minimize that effect while maintaining the incentive. And I'd suggest to Representative Donnelly that he consider $50 if he thinks it would still achieve his purposes.
Mr. Chairman, I think that if the maker of the amendment is serious about his interest in aiding victims of violent crimes, that the $100 is going to come out of a person who's been victimized pocket, because that person perhaps, without the amendment, that person has access to the full dividend without this amendment. And with the amendment, he or she has only access to the dividend less $100. And so if you're really interested in putting dollars in the pocket of violent crime victims, this amendment takes money out of their pockets. It doesn't, because it retains in everyone's pocket $100. So if you victimized somebody and you are under court order to pay restitution, you pay restitution only up to, well, $750 or whatever the dividend was, less $100 this year, for instance.
Representative,
I think maybe the missing part of this equation, do we know how many people have just stopped applying because they don't get anything anyway? I mean, are there people out there that their whole, you know, what number of people out there have just decided, heck with it, you know, I'm not getting anything, so why should I bother to apply? Now, if there's 1 in 8 who are doing that, then I guess we're back to, you know, this works. If a certain percentage of people have decided it's all taken anyway, so just, you know, why should I do this, and my debt, you know, the people I owe money to, all these people are getting it, I'm not realizing a penny, so I'm not going to bother to apply. If this gave them incentive to apply, then, you know, how much less would the victim receive? I mean, I don't know the percentage of people. I don't know if anybody knows, how many people are out there who have stopped applying because their whole check is just consumed by those to whom they owe a debt or child support.
We have the amendment before us. Is there any desire to change that? Representative.
Discussion?
Yes.
Yeah. President Boyer's right. If somebody did apply and a victim tried to access, this would mean the victim could get $100 less. But an existing law, if they don't apply and there's no incentive for them to apply, they get zero. So I think this is a much better policy call. Also, this makes one uniform way to deal with these exemptions instead of the two-tier and multi-tier system we've got now, which is real confusing. It means people could access a check for $500 one way and $400 another way. And it'd be much better to have one simple formula. First $100, hold harmless. Everything else is available. Use the steps. And after the steps, the priority, then after that, it's whoever got there first. And it'd be a lot more simple to administer. Third, when this law was adopted, the amount of the dividends was about $400. So 50% was about $200. I mean, I don't think anybody ever intended the exemption to run up to the level it has now, where 50% of 800 or 1,000 or whatever the dividend goes to. I think this is a good policy call for the next decade, the next 20 years, to change this and make this a flat $100 this way.
I don't want to amend the amendment, but I just wanted to see if Representative Don has interest in changing it to 50. If not, I'll live with his choice.
Changing that to 50?
Yeah.
I don't have a big problem with that.
It would conform with the CS on the amount that now
is that on line 20?
Line 10.
I don't want to kid that, Representative Boyer. I was responding
to flatter.
Representative Boyer said.
I am not that young and handsome.
I don't want to kid anybody that the vote for it because it conforms and say I support this, because I think there ought to be more money going into the victim's compensation fund over here, so I was going to move to amend this a little time. So
right.
I just want to put that caveat on here. Only for that reason, I think this number needs to be higher over here, too.
All right, okay, what do we got here? Line 10, $50, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And what about down here?
Yes.
Does it appear any other place?
I don't think so.
No.
All right. So you have the amendment before you. Further discussion on the amendment? The amendment as amended. Representative Finkelstein?
Well, I will defer to Representative Zweig. I'm just going to move the amendment.
Well, no, I think what we're doing here is saying that we want to make sure that we're maximizing the revenues to go to child support, victims compensation, or debts out there that felon. And I think what we're trying to say, or those of us who are trying to get this dollar amount down, is that a minimum amount should be going to that felon, and he should be responsible for paying his debts out there, regardless of what they are. I'd like to see this be zero, but I'm not going to go that far.
Okay. You have the amendment before you. What is the pleasure of the committee? All those. Is there objection?
I object.
Okay. You want to speak to the objection?
I just don't think that it should open it to everybody out in the streets. For that reason, I do object to the amendment.
Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, hold up your hands. Okay, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, the amendment passes. All right, we have committee substitute for House Bill number 255. As amended before. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Now we're back. We're on the specific committee
right.
system. I guess
As amended.
Question I would like to ask the sponsor of the bill. Page 1, lines 21, you said, notwithstanding the law, the Department of Revenue shall withhold $50 from the permanent fund dividend for victims. The question I have is, how much are you authorizing for child support?
Child support currently, for the world of, all other folks out there can access 100%, up to 100% right now.
Okay, and then the second line was for?
Court-ordered restitution.
Which they can get 100%.
Access 100%.
Why are you limiting victims to $50 then and not 100% also?
Victims under court-ordered restitution can access 100%. What we've done is added the world of violent victims of violent crimes that fall under the Violent Crimes Compensation Fund. Current law is all other victims as well, and inclusive of violent crime victims. It's just a call. This guarantees, all it does is guarantee the money goes into the fund. Right now, the only money that goes into that fund is money from convicted felons.
I guess the only thing, when we have testimony from a director or lady, and I forget her name, I apologize, she showed a large disparity in the amount of funds going into it and the amount needed out there. My concern by putting $50 in here is that I don't think you're even going to come anywhere near what they still need out there. Plus, if I remember right, the governor just signed into law victims' crime to go down to include misdemeanors. He just signed it this week, if I'm not mistaken, which means there's going to be an additional increase in the requirement for victims' compensation out there. So I just can't see why we're gonna limit this area when we're giving 100%. I think it should be left open so that every area can generate or maximize return out there.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't understand the motive in limiting it to $50 under the existing law. The legislative intent was that all this money would go into victims' crime compensation funds. And this bill now says that even when, and the whole purpose of this bill was to let people who had child support payments access this money. Well, they're out. I mean, they get their child support under this proposal. And now what about those checks out there that aren't needed to be accessed for child support money? Now, not only are we exempting those other checks from making a contribution to the victims, but now we're taking them down to $50 at 800.
What victims, I mean, Mr. Chairman, what victims are we talking, what class, I mean?
We're talking about the class of incarcerated felons who don't have claims by child support folks or by court-ordered restitution funds are sitting there and they don't have anything other than $50 going into the victims of crime. Where currently 100% of that money under the existing law is supposed to be dedicated to this, whether the administration does it or not. It's supposed to be that as the legislative intent last year. So we've taken them down from 800 something to 50 here. And this ought to be just that all the remainder of this money, less the deduction amount, should go into the victim's compensation fund if it isn't accessed by one of the priority things, which is that tier of hierarchy, which is child support, court-ordered restitution, or the fines, state fines. So this shouldn't be a $50 limit. It should be just everything but the $50 exception that we adopted here. And that still leaves them a motive to apply for the checks. And I guess I'll throw that on the table as a conceptual amendment so we can have discussion on that.
Could you, Mr. Chairman, could he restate his concept then?
Yes, right.
The concept is that
I'd
all
like to
the
have
money.
It written out.
The concept is that all the money in the permanent fund dividend of each incarcerated felon would be put towards the victim's compensation fund except for the $50 exception.
Question, Mr.
I'd like to have Representative Boyer reply on that.
I'm not sure how that would work exactly. I see where you're trying to go, that in the prioritization now, if you just left it open as it is with the amount open as it is with CSED and court ordered restitution and fines and any other state taking that would include things like the repayment of student loans and the like, I don't know that leaving it open causes a serious problem, because we've set, as long as the priority is here, so that it would fall after CSED, after court ordered restitution to victims, and if it would fall third here, I'm not sure that it would cause a serious problem.
Yeah. And again, not to belabor the point or continue discussion, I just think that regardless of where there is a debt, I think those people should be able to maximize their payment back to them. They should. The felon should pay the full amount. And in this case, he's only going to pay about $750 out of the $800. I don't think we should limit it to anybody. You talked about student loan. And we got a 19% student loan. If we got some of the felons that are sitting in prison and they owe our student loan, which is in trouble now because of the default rate, I think the department should come by and be able to get at least $750 from that individual. I think if there's a victim out there that's not being compensated through the courts, he or she should be able to get the $750 out there. We're doing it for child support. You know, it should be equitable and equal for everybody out there. That felon's got a debt he should pay, and unfortunately he's only going to pay $750. I'm sure there's a lot of them that owe a lot more.
Well, Mr. Chairman, unfortunately he's not paying anything now. It's all going to the state general fund, and we're spending it on sex offender programs and the Department of Corrections and things like that.
Yeah, make some of the people who are running the Department of Revenue criminal for what they're doing and put it where it belongs.
What's the pleasure of the committee?
Well, I have an amendment for the
a conceptual
committee.
One.
Right, but I would just ask that it could be easily drafted, the drafters to do that. If we're not going to
take the time to do it in subcommittee, and we're going to have to take the time to do it here.
Wouldn't that do it? Isn't that what you had originally?
We've adopted this. This is okay.
Do we adopt everything?
Yeah, we adopt everything. No, I think we just have to say something to the effect that notwithstanding any large department revenue shall withhold permanent fund dividend of each individual convicted of a crime and pay that amount into the compensation.
Why don't you write it? We have a 3-minute recess and write it out and we get a copy.
And then leave the other language the same.
Right.
In theory, one could access everything with the exception of
the
$50. Right.
With the exception.
Right. So that if you had a, you could take the CSED payments, you could take other violent court ordered restitution payments, and then the third taking would be all of the dividend that would, and then it would go into the crime compensation fund,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of the $50 that you've limited or
okay,
accepted here.
So I guess, Mr. Chairman, if you want me to make my motion precise, I move that on line 21 of the CS, we delete the words $50 from.
An objection? So moved. Okay, what's the pleasure of the committee on the amended committee substitute?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the amended committee substitute.
Any objections?
I'll object.
Okay. All those in favor of moving it out of committee signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Oh. Wait, I think we may have a conflict. If we back up. If you go to page 3, lines 22, we're back to the 50% of the permanent fund dividend is exempt.
I think.
Did your amendment take that out?
Did, section three.
I just want to make sure that. 23, 23, 65, 8. Okay, that's right. It's amended.
Takes it out?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
I think
we have the committee substitute as amended before.
Just want to make before we go
out of committee with individual recommendations.
I did already move it, but I just wanted to offer one thought, which is that if obviously this gets to be a little bit of complex bill drafting, if it's possible to get a chance to run it by Representative Donnelly again, just the process, just to make sure we didn't miss anything, I think I'd feel more comfortable.
There's no problem with that.
Mr. Chairman, if the discussion is over, I'd make the motion that we move CS House Bill 255. Go ahead.
Any objections?
I'm a no vote. I'm voting the bill.
Okay.
All right.
Your objection? Okay. All those in favor of moving it out with individual recommendations signify by saying aye. Opposed? Moves out to the next committee of referral.
Thank you.
Make sure that before it goes on over here, I can pull it back if there's a problem.
Mr. Chairman, I have to.
Before we sign off, I'll send it on over there. I'll get a copy. God, I don't make anybody happy today.
You're going to find the legislation.
Well, right. Whatever. We've got our different styles. All right, what's the next item before us, Dennis?
232.
Which
one? 232.
Okay, that's House Bill 232. Oh, yeah, something more technological, a fax machine. Okay, we have House Bill 232, an act relating to the use of facsimile devices for commercial solicitation before us. And we have several people online that want to testify. Is it Luis Marquez? He's online.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mintz is also online. He indicated he's with the AG's office and indicated he had no testimony but would be available to answer questions.
Okay. Mr. Marquez, we are now taking up your legislation on House Bill 232, an act relating to the use of facsimile devices for commercial solicitation. You indicated that you wanted to testify, and would you go ahead, sir?
Yes, that is correct. Good point. I'd like to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to participate in this teleconference. I have a business called Fax Direct Advertising. I've been in business 6.5 months. I do this here in Anchorage. I have a database of 2,000 fax numbers just in Anchorage. That's where I strictly send faxes. And by the mayor, I believe I'm the only type of business in the state that handles this or does fax advertising. And I'm directly opposed to this because it affects my business directly. And my question is, why ban it? Why can't we self-regulate ourselves, pass some sort of an amendment that would state, so that we can self-regulate ourselves? What my policy is something I've started myself, and this is how I operate my business. That when it comes to fax transmission or fax advertising, I transmit after hours, after business hours, between 6:30 p.m. and 7:30 a.m. I identify myself with fax number and phone number on any piece of advertising that is transmitted. I also have a policy that I delete people's names off a database they should request. And by identifying myself initially, they could contact me and fax back to me that they would like to be deleted off this list. Anyone that faxes back to me, I personally call them to let them know they've been dropped from the list and seek additional information concerning their thoughts or ideas on fax advertising. Just to add to my knowledge and just for database also. I also screen and solicit the type of ads that I send. I'm the judge if there's something I deem obnoxious. If I send out obnoxious ads or anything, it would affect my business directly. And I'm not a business to get people angry or to send anything what I deem obnoxious. And I also limit the size of the ads that are sent out. Anything 8.5 by 11 or smaller is what it is. And the main thing that I have, since I have a 2,000 number database, I do not sell my list. This is my sole business, and the list is my business. That's one concern I've heard from people that receive faxes, that they're afraid my list would get in the hands of other people, which bring up competition. It took me 4.5 months to compile this list through different directories, referrals, business cards, business contacts. And whatever I send out, usually 600 to 1,000 faxes at one time, it goes over overnight, or it takes 2 days. The equipment I have is physically impossible due to the time constraints to send more than 750 faxes in one evening. And the return on people asking to be deleted is only 1-2% on a transmission. And that translated is 4 to 8 people out of 750 people. So out of that, 742 people like to receive advertising of some sort. My other argument on this is, why legislate an opportunity? I feel fax advertising is an opportunity for businesses to receive services, be knowledgeable of what's out there, and for other businesses to conduct business with other businesses. And this provides information between various types of businesses, and I don't feel we should ban this type of opportunity. And by doing so, you would be hurting Alaska businesses from this opportunity and penalizing people from wanting to receive benefits and services that I provide. The other thing that is local phone utilities would be adversely affected by such a ban. I have some figures here from across nationwide that there are 8 billion fax messages being sent on a daily basis. 50% of these could be considered unsolicited. Unsolicited is the type of business I would be sending, or from company to company sending a brochure or any type of unsolicited piece of information. And business calls would drop if there was some sort of ban. They would be very careful on what was sent out. And this means a drop in income to the phone companies. Rates could conceivably be increased to make up for this lost income. I think businesses would be less apt to send any type of fax messages or information to their your distributor, to your dealers, or your competition, or just about anybody. If there is a ban where can't send unsolicited faxes, you would have to have somebody standing by the fax machine to deem what's unsolicited. You know, who requested this? Run to the office saying, did somebody request this? Did believe that's the biggest
kind
complaint.
Lonely down there.
The cost of papers. Studies of film papers anywhere from 3 cents to 7 cents, depending on how you buy and where you buy. Right now in Anchorage, I did 2.5 months of market research before I started this company, talking to people that would be receiving faxes, people that would be sending faxes. And the response was good. I wouldn't say it was very good, but it was good. It's a new idea of fax advertising. And this is something you would have to sell to people, sell a new type of service.
You get your bill out of this.
I'm something people are a little cautious about it, but it's, so far I've had a number of clients that have used it and they're very happy with the result. I'm open to questions. I do open mics on.
Thank you.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you for your presentation. I
well, I have more. I'll continue. I have another. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I thought you were finished. I'll wait.
No, that's about what I have. I just have a number of bills right now. There are 5 bills in the House in California. 3 of them have been shot down. 2 of them are just in committee. Right now, as far as I know, 1 state, Maryland, has passed some sort of legislation banning fax advertising or fax solicitation. Other states have tried Washington, Connecticut, New York, Oregon. Nothing has passed. I'll end it right there.
Well, thank you for your presentation. I'll tell you just my thoughts on all. I think you make a pretty convincing case. The only fear I have is that you know, although there may not be much problem now, if there were a lot of people operating in the future, the cost of paper, while it may not be significant just with your own operation in effect, if you had a number of other people operating in the area, the cost of paper to people leaving their fax on overnight could be considerable, and they'd be forced into decision whether to turn off their faxes at night. And I think that, you know, that there is probably the biggest problem I see, but I do share your point of view that at this point there isn't much of a problem.
Well, that's true. I'd like to add to that. Right here in the state of Alaska, there's only 2 outside companies that would be sending any sort of fax to the state, and that's on a once-a-month type basis, if that. I don't know who is receiving faxes. I do send locally here. People receive something from me maybe once, twice a week, if that. And this is a sort of marketing where I could target my market by area of the city, type of business, by SIC code, telephone prefix numbers. That's all handled through a database and a program. But people that are receiving, I think it's blown out of proportion, especially here in Alaska. There's quite a number of fax machines per capita in Alaska because the fax businesses deal with lower 48 on a daily basis. This is the best way to receive and send information. But nationwide, there isn't. I think it's a media event that's been blown out of proportion. Frankly, I was surprised that Alaska had instituted some sort of legislation concerning this, where I don't see it as a problem here whatsoever. I believe we're kind of getting on the bandwagon due to other states trying to pass legislation.
Is it the cost?
I would like to see it self-regulated. Let us regulate ourselves. I'm registered with the Better Business Bureau, and I say the same facts to them. Since I'm the only one in the state that's speaking up, I hate to see this pass, and I'm directly opposed to it.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Robert Minch from the AG's office is online. Bob, would you care to comment on the discussion so far?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of points in Mr. Marquez's testimony that I had an idea on. One, he said that he gets a response rate of about 1 to 2% from the recipients asking to be removed from the from his list. I find that quite easy to accept, but what I think that figure has to be taken with cautiously in this sense. National studies of consumer complaints have found that on average, for every customer of a business that actually complains to the business, there are 26 other customers who are similarly dissatisfied that don't go to the trouble of complaining for whatever reason. They don't think they'll do any good. It's too too much trouble, they don't know how, whatever. So if the same figure applied here, we might have 26 to 52% of the customers actually not real happy about being on the list. The second point I mentioned is that it's my understanding that some people and some businesses do use their fax machines at night and may be expecting to receive messages. As I understand it, the concept behind singling out so-called junk fax advertising for special treatment, as well as what the statutes already refer to as junk telephone calls, is that it's sort of an idea of a third party appropriating one's own property for their private use without getting your permission ahead of time. And there's the issue of the paper, but there's also the issue of tying up this equipment that the owner is really devoting to his own purposes. And whenever there's an unsolicited message appearing, that's obviously interfering with that. You know, I suppose an analogy would be Norman has suggested that one ought to ban TV advertising, but if you sit down to watch your program, your favorite program on TV, you don't want to have some third party interjecting an advertisement that's coming over your system that keeps you from watching that program. I'm good. I would, Mr. Marquez is correct. Our information also is that Maryland, the legislature has passed a law in this area, and that in a number of other states, legislation is still pending. My main purpose really is just to answer questions, if there are any, on what, if any, experience we've had in areas like this. I had also had a couple of technical comments on the earlier version of the bill that I have. I don't believe I have
that. Do you have the committee substitute before you, Bob?
No, I don't have that.
Okay, we will fax that up to you.
I won't consider that a junk fax.
You can call us and give us your number, so it won't be added to that list. Mine's unlisted.
Thank you. Well, I may have it on my database. I'm sure you do. Mr. Mitch, I'd like to interject. Concerning people having fax machines, again, a fax transmittal is a phone call. It goes over a phone line, and it's strictly a phone call. And if you're tying up your line with a phone call or a fax transmission, I believe they're one and the same. And people have, nationwide, people have more than $4 billion worth in fax equipment.
Right.
If legislation bans this machinery would be obsolete or limited use to them. That was the sole purpose of having the machine. Business transactions. Receiving things on a timely basis. What I would like to propose is a study for at least a year to see what happens here in Alaska concerning fax advertising. I think it's a little premature right now to base anything in legislation or self-regulation on what's been going on in the state. If I'm the sole type of business doing this, I don't see there's a problem.
I think we're still in the room.
This is Robert Mintz again. I guess the only thing I'd have to add here is that
I'm sorry, David.
It does. I do agree. It appears to be a problem or a phenomenon that's in its infancy.
Exactly.
What the implication is for public policy, I guess, is a question of debate. Is it better public policy to wait until a problem becomes a major problem, or is it better to nip it in the bud? I guess Mr. Marquez's viewpoint would be, well, maybe it's not a problem, maybe it's a benefit, but certainly from what we do know is, in terms of public perception, people don't like to get unsolicited
I don't believe I'm tying up a person's time physically. I said after hours, somebody walks in their office, there's a fax sitting in the basket,
you
or what's
just
that?
Hop in whenever you
that's
want.
The extent of it. And you have to have show me some
you.
Figures where people don't like to
he
receive. I have I substantiate my
he
figures 1 to 2% return that do not like to receive this. And you see this put on a broader base. I have figures on that. I have substantiated that.
Mr. Marquez?
Yes.
What we'd like to do here is the way we normally conduct hearings is you let one finish and then you call on the other person. Otherwise, we've got a conversation going here. And we do have some of the committee members at this end that have additional questions.
Okay.
So I'll give you an opportunity to be heard. Just listen to what is being said and I'll call on you again.
Yes, sir.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, and my question was for Mr. Mintz. Tell me again what the perception is on the number of complaints and how that's interpreted by some to be a larger group that doesn't complain. Could you give me those figures again, please?
This, of course, doesn't have anything specifically to do with junk facts. It's a number of studies that have been done in the past of consumer behavior, and it's been published among other places in a publication that the Coca-Cola company put out. The figures in general are only 1 out of 26 dissatisfied customers on average will actually take the trouble to communicate a complaint to the company that they have a problem with. So the lesson for businesses in general is there are on average 26 times as many people out there that are unhappy about something as the ones you hear from.
Thank you, Mr. Mintz. And a question that's a slight aside from what we're talking about, but it does relate to enforcement. What's the, I can't recall offhand what the level in the House budget is for consumer protection. Do you have that off the top of your head, the reduction?
I believe it's essentially the same as the current fiscal year, which I think is $324,000. There might be a slight adjustment in there, but that's the order of magnitude.
Okay. I realize this is a little bit away from the subject, but it does relate to enforcement. Just in the area of unsolicited advertising, period, not talking now just about faxes or telephone calls, do you feel that you're able to follow up on complaints in that area, or have you had to drop it for lack of staff?
In the area of complaint mediation, which is trying to handle individual consumers, individual problems, as opposed to law enforcement, that's had to be cut back by over 80% over the last couple of years, simply because our consumer complaint mediation staff in Anchorage has been eliminated and in Juneau. So most consumers that need help on individual problems in this area and other areas can't no longer get it. Well, we're limited to trying to take law enforcement action in selected cases.
Okay, thank you. And I know one of your relatives, Daniel, since you're in this kind of stuff, do you know if Daniel has an opinion on any of this matters, or says he'd be involved?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that.
Oh, no, I'll drop that question. Thanks. Appreciate your time, Mr. Mintz.
It's time to go into session. What I'm going to do is recess it and see if you can find a time that the committee members can get.
I'll see if I can get them together.
Okay. Just pick a time if we can just get a quorum together this afternoon. Otherwise, we'll keep bumping this stuff by.
Okay.
House State Affairs is going to stand in recess. We've got the session going in now at 10:02, and hopefully we are not, just so Mr. Marquez, we do not plan to move the legislation out of this committee today. We're going to fax up the copy to Mr. Mintz of the committee of the committee substitute, and quite possibly we're going to make sure that there's enough time for input in on this subject, Mr. Marquez.
Okay.
But not a year. House State Affairs stands in recess at the call of the chair. State Affairs back to order. We have Senate Bill 144, an act relating to relocation assistance for federally assisted projects and programs and providing for effective date. This is a Senate bill that came by a request of the governor. Go ahead and start your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Milton Lance, and I'm a chief right-of-way of land acquisitions for the Department of Transportation here in headquarters in Juneau. The purpose of this bill is to change Title 34, Chapter 60 of the Relocation Assistance Act, so to bring it into conformity with the 1987 amendments of the Surface Transportation and Uniform Relocation Act. Very briefly, the background on this, these proposed changes is in 1987, there were a number of technical changes made in the Uniform Act by Congress to facilitate what they considered inflationary adjustments from the 1971 values. The law applies to every recipient of the receipt of federal assistance within the state, including municipalities, universities, and state agencies. Any project would result in the relocation of business or residents cannot be supported without these changes. Although we have the DOT under FAA and FHWA, we have assurances in the statutes that allow us to assent to this particular requirements or the changes in these requirements. However, without a change in the statutes, there are numerous agencies such as the EPA funding for municipality water treatment projects, land conservation funds for parks, HUD funding for housing, and funding for DNR could be affected by not bringing our statutes up in compliance. There's a zero fiscal note on that. And although it would probably cost the federal government about $50,000 per year to meet these new requirements, the cost would be spread over $180 million, or our general funded money would just be nominal. That's sort of it in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman. There are some changes. I'd be glad to go over them with you or answer any questions that I may.
What do you mean, some changes?
The changes in the statutes have gone from minimums to maximums. For example, if we go back to the bill itself, and I'll just pull out an example here under page number 3, the limitations used to be $15,000 for a displaced person from a dwelling. And now that has been changed to 22.5 under the new federal law. Other minor changes are that people can receive greater benefits for their moving expenses. Businesses are not eligible under the federal law to receive up to $10,000 for reestablishment payment, which was not in there before. And in lieu of moving payments, now it's up to $2,500 to $10,000 if the business cannot be relocated. And the down payment requirement, which used to be $400, is now for displaced tenants, is now up to $5,200.
Any questions from the committee? Representative McLean, did you have any questions?
No, he answered it. What were the changes? In the minimum and maximum payments.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm reading the letter from the governor. I guess this would make a change for businesses as well. And I guess I was thinking of a situation in my district where Raspberry Road is going to be widened, and there's a gas station up at the corner. And we had quite a bit of correspondence with him, I guess, about relocating that particular business. So this would apply. Let's see, for the business, it increases what? It says no more than $20,000, is that?
The business, if the businesses were to go out of business and could not be relocated in that, why, we would have up to, from $2,500 up to $10,000. Mm-hmm. And in the lieu would be from $1,000 to $20,000. If I may make a comment, we already, the Department of Transportation on federal aid projects is already using this particular process by statutory authority of assenting to federal requirements. So I
that's
believe...
Federal, that's federal, I think there's federal funding involved in that Raspberry Road project.
Yes, ma'am, it would be all federal funding.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 144 out of the committee with individual recommendation.
Any objection? So moved. House State Affairs is adjourned at 12:00. Thank you very much for coming back. I appreciate it.